Well, thank you very much, David, and good evening, everyone. We've had three great presentations focusing on the science and focusing on what we need to do. So I'm going to give a slightly more gloomy presentation about, you know, where the politics are and what the constraints are. But I hope I'm also going to sort of suggest some ways forward, given the challenging politics, where we can make progress on tackling these issues. So if I could have the first slide, please. So, as many of you be aware, the UK has chosen to host the next major climate meeting, which was to have been at the end of this year in Glasgow, will now be the end of next year. I think it was inevitable, given COVID, that that was delayed. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what Glasgow needs to do when it happens. And I'll talk a bit then about what was, in my understanding, the UK strategy pre-COVID, and how and then secondly, how COVID has caused that strategy to change a bit. So next slide, please. So Glasgow is a bit different from the big Paris Agreement that was in 2015. Paris was essentially negotiating a treaty, but alongside Paris, there were commitments from countries to reduce their emissions. And these were called, in the jargon, nationally determined contributions. These were significant, and they did probably reduce emissions by about a third of what we needed to do to be on track for 2 degrees, but that meant that they left a big gap. And so the Paris provided for a 5-yearly cycle whereby these targets would be revisited and, in principle, the ambition raised. And Glasgow is the first of these 5-year cycles. So the key thing that Glasgow needs to do is raise country ambition. And that will probably happen not in Glasgow itself through negotiation, but to a large extent in capitals before Glasgow even happens. So next slide, please. So this is a rather busy and detailed slide, and I know you're all boffins, so you'll understand it all. But it's an important slide, and it's, although it looks rather busy, it's actually quite simple. What it actually shows us, if you look at the top black line, that shows us what emissions would be in 2030 in the absence of country action. We'd be about 64 gigatons of CO2 equivalent emissions in 2030. But then if you look at the shaded areas at the bottom, you'll see that to be on track for well below 2 degrees, we should be emitting around about 41 gigatons in 2030. Or to be on track for 1.5, we should be emitting about 24 gigatons. Whereas the Paris commitments, which are the two lines just below the black line, might take us to about 54. So there's a lot of numbers there, but essentially, what we would need to do in Glasgow to get on track for 2 degrees would be to reduce emissions by 15 billion tons, i.e., by 25% against current levels, or to be on track for 1.5 degrees by 30 billion tons. As one of the other speakers said, we would need to halve them. Now, I have to say that my political, and it's a political assessment, it's not a technical assessment, is that that is not remotely feasible that that will happen in Glasgow. You know, and this is essentially because no countries have made climate change a core issue for them where they absolutely want to reduce emissions at all costs. I would say the EU and the UK are amongst the most ambitious, but no country has. My back of envelope calculation suggests the very best we might do is about 5 or 6 gigatons, which is not nothing, but it's clearly, you know, not, you know, it's not enough in terms of the scale of the challenge. Of that 5 or 6, around half is in China. China is bigger than the EU and the US put together. They simply matter more than we do. Most of the world's, virtually all of the world's growth is from emerging economies and developing countries. So, you know, we have to persuade them. It's not just about UK or Europe leading, although we must lead and we must agree on equity grounds, do more than others, but we need to persuade them. Next slide, please. So, what was the strategy in light of all this pre-COVID? Next slide, please. So I think the UK government understood how challenging the ambition gap was. It's also true that the geopolitics were pretty bad even before COVID, and much worse than they were in Paris, which was a uniquely benign set of circumstances in 2015. I think there are also issues, to be honest, that the COP presidency, UK, has huge other priorities thanks to Brexit, and climate was not on leaders' mind even before COVID. So what was the strategy? Next slide, please. I think the first thing they were after was to get as much ambition on country pledges as possible, obviously. The second thing is that actually there are things we can do in the real world, in the real economy, which can take us further. And there's obviously a risk of greenwash here, but it's true that renewable energy on a levelized cost basis is cheaper than coal in most parts of the world. Coal persists often for political economy reasons, not because it's actually more cost effective. Electric vehicles will soon, if not already, be cheaper than internal combustion engines, for example. So there was a whole raft of real economy and real world initiatives in train, one led by Mark Carney to essentially ultimately require companies and investors to mainstream climate risk in all their decision making. That sort of thing can be really powerful driver along with country pledges. And then the third thing that the UK would have wanted to do would be to have a narrative. This is not about to essentially communicate that what would have been achieved would still be a big step forward. And this is not about, you know, trying to gloss over something that's inadequate, but it's important that we create this continued momentum, this continued inevitability about climate action. We don't want the signal from Glasgow to be, you know, the world's backed off, so I can back off, you know, investing in climate smart solutions. You know, I'm not going to take that proposal to my investment committee because it's not the direction the world is going. So that was the overall strategy, I think. I can't speak for them, but I think of the UK government before COVID. So how has COVID changed things? Next slide, please. So I've suggested four ways in which COVID has changed things so far. The first one is that inevitably COVID has soaked up all of the political oxygen in pretty well most countries of the world. So climate has been eclipsed for now. The question is, can we, as we come out of this COVID crisis, I think there's a sense we are going to need fiscal stimulus packages to get the economy moving again. I think a key focus is to be to get those fiscal stimulus packages to be climate smart, sustainable. The EU's made a start with the Green Deal. That's only the EU budget. It's not the member state budgets. And there's certainly risks around, you know, protecting the car industry or protecting aviation industry in parts of Europe even. I think the UK is clearly thinking about this, haven't resolved it yet. I'm not quite as optimistic about China as Rob was. I mean, I think the announcement that was made by the Chinese leadership last week was relatively unpromising on climate and environment, but you know, there's still elements to play for, and we should continue to press. The second thing that we've seen from COVID is behavioural change. So, you know, will these changes be permanent? Will these people travelling less, using video conferencing more, will that be permanent? Will that have a long-term effect on emissions? I hope so. And can we reinforce those trends? The kind of meta trend I would hope to see is that we essentially understand that preparing for big risks, particularly ones we know like climate, we know are coming, like climate change, is a no-brainer. You know, it would have been massively, massively cheaper for us to prepared for coronavirus had we known it was coming. The third big change is geopolitics, which were pretty bad already. I think COVID has accentuated them. Tensions between China and the US, but tensions between the EU and China as well. I think we, you know, again, we're going to have to look at where we can try to rebuild the politics and maybe find climate as a kind of safe space where countries can cooperate, and biodiversity as well, I agree, is a priority. And then the fourth thing is the process. Clearly the COP has been deferred, as others have said. I think that was the right decision by the UK. I think it was inevitable. But the key thing that also does is it pushes the COP beyond the US election. So that significantly changes the political outlook for the election. Final slide, please, and then I'll stop. So what does that mean for the strategy? Short term, basically the underlying objectives are unchanged, but the short term focus is be green those fiscal stimulus packages when they come. In the medium term, if it's Biden, I think we have got a chance. Biden has said he's going to convene major emitters next year. I think that could be a key moment to try and find an understanding between the major players. If it's Trump, UK is going to have to work with the EU to create an EU-China moment. And finally, the expectations on the UK are going to be very high. We are going to need to raise our own target. There's going to be all, you know, as the COP president, we're going to have to be, as I put it here, Caesar's wife, beyond reproach. We're going to have to use our political capital when we've got many other calls on that capital. So it's opportunities for the UK and global Britain, but big challenges and risks as well. Thank you.